You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a Portland-based journalist about the ongoing protests in Oregon's largest city and why lawmakers are arguing that arrests made by federal law enforcement have made the situation worse. Now a new hotline is being piloted for farmers facing stress and other mental health issues here in Wisconsin. The Farmer Wellness Program now includes a 24-hour confidential counseling hotline for farmers and for their families. Our next guest joins us to talk about the program and the challenges farmers are facing here in the state. Jane Krull is director of the Farm Center for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, or DATCAP. Jane, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us why the department wanted to start this counseling line for farmers?
Well, we've had a Wisconsin Farm Center, a team of very dedicated professionals helping farmers. We have a 800 number that's been around since it was born out of the 80s farm crisis. So we provide financial assistance, mediation, counseling, that type of thing. And we've always seen the need for something like this, but we've really seen the growing need in the last few years with all the extra stress and challenges farmers are going through, the intensity of the calls, and the stress and the anxiety that the farmers are going through. So we're finally able to make that happen, thankfully, due to some funding that was provided in Governor Evers' 2019 to 2021 biennial budget and approved by the state legislature.
Now, 2020 has brought, I think, special, unique challenges that we'll get to in a minute. But can you talk a little more about, even up through last year, some of the challenges when it came to mental and emotional health concerns that you're trying to tackle here?
Sure. There's just so many challenges going on that are unique to the farming occupation. But it's definitely been increased in the last couple of years with all the weather challenges we've had, the wet season. Some farmers weren't even able to get a crop in last year. We've got majorly fluctuating milk prices, for instance, here in Wisconsin, and just general commodity prices. And a lot happening more recently, as you know, with COVID, some additional challenges as well.
Yeah, now talk about how COVID-19 has made the kind of worrisome situation even worse.
Yeah, you know, when COVID was first hitting, we did have calls to the Farm Center with people asking, like, what does this mean? How is this going to impact me? And we didn't know, but boy, it sure came on fast. We had a major disruption to the food supply chain, as everyone knows now, especially for our dairy farmers, our livestock and meat industry, that type of thing. So, they were definitely affected by that and just the general challenges that came along with COVID and having to do things differently on their farm.
We're talking to Jane Krull, director of the Farm Center for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, looking at a new farmer wellness an ongoing farmer wellness program, a new hotline also for farmers facing stress and other mental health issues. So if a farmer calls up, what can they expect if they dial the line?
Sure. If you dial the 24/7 line, you can call any time of day. That's what we're really excited about, any day of the week. You can expect to talk to someone who's ready to speak to you, a listening ear for you. We've basically given some training to these counselors. They already have some farm experience talking to farmers, but we did go through about a month making them familiar with the specific challenges we have here in our state, and they're ready to talk to you. So when you call, you'll have to, you know, answer a couple questions in the beginning just to kind of screen and see how critical is the situation. It can be any level. Please call the number if you just want to talk to somebody or if you're in a more serious situation, either way. But they'll be screening you in the beginning kind of to gauge what's going on real quickly because they want to get to the root of the matter. And then you can talk for as long as you want. It could be 5 minutes or an hour, but just someone to talk to lend an ear to you if you are feeling a lot of stress and anxiety on that particular day.
And I should ask if there's a farmer out there listening thinking, yeah, I could use something like this. What's the number? What number do they call for this?
Sure. The number is 888-901-2558. And again, it's 888-901-2558. Again, available 24/7.
Now, this is a service, a new service you're providing. It's not the only thing out there. And I understand your group has been doing trainings, working on trainings for people, maybe not just the farmers themselves or people who work with them, people in communities, to try to assess mental health risks and possible suicide risks. Can you talk about what's out there?
Sure. We're doing quite a few things related to farmer mental health the last couple of years, thanks to the legislative money we were given. So we are doing things like a podcast. We know a lot of people can't get out and meet face-to-face these days, but we want to let them know they're not alone. So we launched about a month ago something called Rural Realities. It's a podcast regarding all farm topics, but we're starting out with a series of 5 farmer mental health related topics. So we've got some great topics about farm family communication and farm financials. When is the point you should reach out for help? How your brain is affected by stress, which is important. There's a stigma with farmers and mental health, I think. Someone in Minnesota that we worked with on the training part of it, who's been doing this for many years, talking to farmers, is Ted Williams and Mona McConkie in Minnesota. And they had said something great to me, which is, mental health does not always mean mental illness. You need to take care of your mental health just like you do your heart or a broken leg or that type of thing. So that's why, hopefully people aren't afraid to reach out anymore. We want to really break that stigma of farmer mental health. Some of the other things we're doing is we're offering QPR trainings coming up here shortly. They will all be virtual now. We've got 6 going on. The first one is July 29th, and there's different times and times of the day and different days of the week that we're doing between now and October 1st. QPR stands for Question, Persuade, Refer, and those are 2-hour sessions where you can get a quick training on how to look for signs when you're talking to farmers, whether you be an ag service provider who's going to the farm, like a milk hauler or a vet, or the farmer themselves talking to another farmer. What are the signs you look for in a farmer who may be going through extra stress or even possibly a suicidal situation, and how to help them get help?
Those are just
a few examples of what we're doing.
Sure. This is an important time for this. And I think I read you were talking about this elsewhere, Jane, that with COVID-19 causing these extra economic stresses, it's also taking away, those social connections that farmers might have relied on to keep their mental well-being up. Maybe the, whatever it is, the meeting at the diner, the trip to church, things that, maybe they could do. Maybe if they're physically at risk, they don't want to be out in groups. That's something that they don't have right now, farmers, that they would usually have.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. I think we all are experiencing more isolation than we're used to, but the farming occupation itself is already quite an isolating job you're doing on your own in many cases. So it's important that farmers get out a little bit, and now it's even harder to do that. So that's why another reason why this funding has come at such a good time, that we can offer different ways that you can, make a phone call, have a listening ear, or listen to a podcast, or just to know you're not alone, to go to these sessions, that type of thing. We're trying to offer different avenues that you can still reach out.
I know it's a new program and too soon to tell how it's working, but how do you evaluate the success of this hotline over the next couple few months?
Yes, this hotline we've been wanting so long, it is just a pilot program that we're doing for 8 or 9 months to see what response we get, because we knew we needed to get this out to the farmers when this funding was available. So we're really excited about it. We're going to measure the success not only by the number of calls, of course, but the importance of the calls and, who did we help. Obviously, everything's free and confidential, what the Farm Center does, including these farmer mental health services. So, you don't have to give your name and all your information. Don't worry about that. But we will, have an understanding of the nature of the calls and how, how many calls we're getting. But to me, even if only, 10 farmers call a week, which may not seem a lot, that's 10 farmers we helped that needed that lending ear that we may have prevented them from extra stress or given them practical tools to help with that situation or to even prevent a suicidal crisis situation.
Jane, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Jane Krull is director of the Farm Center for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We talked about a new pilot program which provides a confidential 24/7 hotline to farmers facing mental health issues. That hotline number again is 888-901-2558. That's 1-888-901-2558. Coming up, state and local lawmakers in Portland, Oregon are calling on the Trump administration to remove federal agents from the city after militarized law enforcement officials began arresting protesters. We'll talk to a journalist based in Portland about what's going on there. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, schools around Wisconsin and the country are debating whether and how to open in the fall. We'll talk to an educational policy expert about the divide between those who want to reopen completely or remain virtual as the COVID-19 pandemic continues. Now, protesters in Portland, Oregon continue to clash with federal law enforcement agents as the city enters a third month of protests. The demonstrations began after the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police in May. Floyd's killing sparked protests around the country against the use of excessive force by police against Black Americans. And last week, federal authorities from a division of the Department of Homeland Security began arresting protesters, seemingly with no or little cause. The authorities have also been traveling around the city in unmarked vehicles and taking protesters away to undisclosed locations. Now, some state and local lawmakers there are demanding the Trump administration remove those agents, arguing they're making the situation in Portland worse and that these arrests could be unconstitutional. Ryan Haas is a news editor for Oregon Public Broadcasting. He's been covering these demonstrations and the arrests. Ryan, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, Ryan, the protests going on for months there. Can you give us a timeline of federal law enforcement officers arriving and taking action in Portland?
Yeah, so this kind of all goes back to late June when the president put out this order saying that the federal government was going to protect monuments and statues and other federal property that protesters had maybe been graffitiing or causing damage to. And, you know, around July 1st, so shortly after that order, we started to see federal officers appearing on the streets at protests. Now, they weren't really taking a lot of actions at that point, but they were present. And then on July 4th, that's when things really sort of escalated with the federal government. You know, they came out that night, protesters were shooting fireworks off, as happens, you know, on July 4th for a lot of places. And some of these fireworks exploded near the federal courthouse. And we saw federal officers come out at that point and really start tear gassing the crowd and using a lot of impact munitions and other, quote unquote, less lethal weapons to disperse protesters.
And then the story that got a lot of attention over the last few days were of some protesters not actually at the protests or directly in the midst of them, in some cases being taken into unmarked vehicles. What has happened there?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, we've been covering these protests since they began, and we started to see these videos popping up online of protesters saying, hey, someone pulled up in an unmarked van and pulled my friend in, or pulled in someone I saw and just kind of drove away with them. And so we started looking for some of these folks who had been arrested, and we happened to find one of them, and he told just an amazing story of he was just walking down the street away from the protest, nowhere near anything that was going on, and he was going home, and five men pulled up in a van, pulled his hat over his eyes, essentially blinding him, and put him in the van and drove him to an undisclosed location. You know, he was questioned. He did not answer questions. He said, I want a lawyer. They eventually released him. He realized after he got outside, he was inside the federal courthouse the whole time. And, you know, once we reported that story out, it sort of drew a lot of attention to the tactics that federal officers were using here on the streets of Portland.
Do we know which federal agencies are present and who has been doing some of the things you've been talking about?
Yeah, it's kind of a mix of agencies. So there's the U.S. Marshals Service. You know, they're kind of pretty typical federal officers who are within the courthouse here. And then there's also the Federal Protective Service and this unit of Customs and Border Protection called BORTAC, which is kind of a specialty unit. It's sort of like their SWAT team. And they are the ones who have actually been doing these arrests in unmarked vehicles. You know, the U.S. Marshals Service, when we were reporting our story, basically said that we had nothing to do with that. We don't want any part of that. And I've heard, you know, some federal agencies have kind of questioned some of these tactics internally and sort of put it back on Customs and Border Protection to take account for these actions.
We're talking to Ryan Haas, news editor for Oregon Public Broadcasting, about the deployment of federal law enforcement officials in military-style gear in Portland and their acts to contain protests, in some cases, as we heard, pulling people off the streets in unmarked vehicles. I want to give a listen to President Trump talking about the use of these federal law enforcement officials in Portland. Here's some of what he's had to say recently.
They've done a fantastic job. They've been there 3 days. And they really have done a fantastic job in a very short period of time. No problem. They grab them. A lot of people in jail. They're leaders. These are anarchists. These are not protesters. People say protesters. These people are anarchists. These are people that hate our country. And we're not going to let it go forward. And I'll tell you what, the governor and the mayor and the senators out there, they're afraid of these people. That's the reason they don't want us to help them. They're afraid.
So let's talk about some of what the president had to say. 3 days, you were saying earlier it's been longer than 3 days?
Yes, it's been 2 weeks, or well, more than 2 weeks at this point that federal officers have been here. So yeah, that's not accurate.
And the characterization of protesters who have been taken off the streets anyway as anarchists?
Again, I would not say that's accurate. You know, the story we reported about the man who was taken, he had not committed any crimes. He was not charged with any crimes. Customs and Border Protection has not given any explanation of the reason that they arrested him. My, you know, inclination is perhaps it was a case of mistaken identity and they grabbed the wrong person, but they have not explained that. And as far as whether there are anarchists out there, you know, I would say federal agents made a bunch of arrests last night at a protest. And amongst those was this group called Portland Moms, who have come out as a way to sort of stand in front of people who are protesting to kind of show that, hey, you should not be using force on these people. These are just normal moms. It was a group started by a mother who lives in the suburbs here. After she saw what was going on, she kind of put together this group of mothers she knows, and they went down there to demonstrate. And three of those moms were arrested last night by federal agents, and they've been tear gassed many nights by these agents who are on the street here.
I want to talk to you, Ryan, about public perception of what's going on in Portland. There are some outlets and some characterizations that use phrases like Portland is under siege or on fire. And there has been some damage done, certainly by protesters, others sharing videos of peaceful protests over time. How would you characterize the balance between peaceful protest and things we could characterize as violent protest?
I think these are very largely peaceful demonstrations. You know, you're talking about hundreds, and now at this point, now that the federal government has showed up, you're talking about thousands of people who are out there peacefully exercising their First Amendment rights. There are certainly folks who have been arrested who have committed violence. There was one man who was attempting to break down some plywood that's around the courthouse. And when federal officers came running at him, he swung a hammer and tried to hit one of them. He was arrested and has been charged with felony assault. And I think, you know, most people here would say, yes, you should be arresting people who are committing violence. But to say, you know, this most of the protesters are violent, I think is highly inaccurate. I think most of the people are there just to demonstrate.
And what is daily life like in Portland? Again, I think in looking at some coverage of this, it's this idea that Portlandites are living in fear in the midst of all of this. Is this affecting daily life for the most part?
No. I mean, we're talking about the place where this is taking place is essentially two blocks around the federal courthouse downtown. It's a very small portion of the city. I'm looking out the window right now. I see people riding their bikes to the park. I see people walking their dogs. So there does not appear to be an active siege happening here.
Can you talk about now the response from local and state elected officials, whether executive or members of legislatures, state and national?
Yeah, you know, elected officials here have roundly condemned what's going on. They say, we did not ask for this level of federal force to come in here. You know, the mayor of Portland has kind of evolved a little bit. Originally, he was sort of saying, you know, well, if federal officers are here defending federal property, that's their duty and they should be able to do that. And now he's kind of seen how this has escalated and said, look, you guys just need to get out of here. You're making the situation 10 times worse than it was before you showed up. You know, our federal lawmakers have introduced legislation in attempts to dial this back and have just, you know, overtly said the federal government needs to be out of here.
And Ryan, in our last couple of minutes, since the role of these federal law enforcement officials has gotten bigger, what's been the response in terms of things like turnout at protests?
It's been astronomical. Honestly, before this sort of started escalating the situation, you know, I would say protests here were down to maybe 100 people a night. So it was a very small group. And now last night, after this story has kind of blown up and gone around the country, we saw maybe close to 2,000 people. So, you know, we're talking about going back to the levels of protests that were happening shortly after George Floyd was killed by police. So it's only emboldened protesters.
And have the protests become in part against the presence of these federal law enforcement officials?
Yeah, it's really interesting, honestly. So you're seeing a kind of evolution. You know, there's still, it's very much still about racial justice. You know, every night there are people who are Black and brown who are out there talking about how they've lived through systemic racism in Portland. But also there are a group of people, many people who have just said, look, we don't want this level of federal overreach in our city, and federal officers don't have the right to come in here and step on people's constitutional freedoms.
Ryan, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Ryan Haas is a news editor for Oregon Public Broadcasting. We talked about the ongoing protests in Portland and the presence of federal law enforcement in the city. These officers have been asked to leave by state and local lawmakers after arresting protesters. We'll talk more tomorrow, by the way, at the wider issue of the president's use of federal law enforcement officers in cities and states around the country. Up next, we'll talk about schools here in Wisconsin and around the nation as they grapple with the decision to reopen in person or not in the fall during the COVID-19 pandemic, and concerns about how virtual education might reinforce gaps in the quality of education among different groups. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, a personal finance expert joins the show for a look at managing our money during the coronavirus pandemic. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the issue of reopening schools for in-person teaching and learning has been a divisive issue for teachers, administrators, and parents as the COVID-19 pandemic continues. In Wisconsin, the state's largest teachers union is demanding that schools go entirely virtual out of concern for the safety of teachers, students, and staff. Madison and Milwaukee school districts have already decided to be entirely online, at least to start the school year. On the other side of the issue are teachers, parents, and administrators who argue that virtual learning isn't as effective as learning in a classroom. Some school districts like Toma have already reopened for some in-person learning. Wisconsin's not the only state tackling this issue. States like Florida have seen a major outcry over its decision to reopen schools this fall as the number of coronavirus cases spike across the country. John B. Diamond is the Kellner Family Distinguished Chair in Urban Education and Professor of Education and Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis and a faculty affiliate in Afro-American Studies and Educational Policy Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I don't know if anybody has the perfect answer, but what are you hoping district policymakers are thinking about as they think about how to reopen this fall?
I mean, I think first and foremost for me is really trying to take politics out of the decision making as much as possible. I think we've had sort of a national discourse, a state and local discourse that has in some ways been impacted by political decisions rather than health decisions. And so first and foremost, I think the health and safety of the students, teachers, administrators, custodial workers, and everybody who's involved in education, as well as families and parents, are really important to keep in mind.
Now, if schools are going virtual, they've at least had some time to prepare. Do you have any lessons that you think we should be learning from the rapid switch to virtual as COVID-19 was first hitting?
I mean, I think this is really unprecedented, and I think schools in many places have responded well under the circumstances. I think there are three things that I think people should be thinking about, and those are thinking about the resources needed, the relationships that are necessary, and sort of thinking about reflective practice. And when I talk about resources, I'm thinking about one of the challenges that we've seen is that the resources in our schools are unequally distributed across our communities, across our schools. And so some communities were able to adapt more quickly because they had an infrastructure and a set of resources that allowed them to do that. And other districts struggled in making those kind of rapid changes. So I think it's important for us to keep in mind that resources have to be sort of front and center. I guess the second thing is thinking about relationships. You know, what are the relationships like in your community between teachers and administrators, between the district and the school, between the school and the community, and between teachers and parents, and trying to make sure that there's trust in those relationships and that there's a sort of sense of relational trust that can be built for people across the community. And then the final thing I think about is reflective practice. Like, how can we be very cognizant of what we learned in the spring and what we can take from that to sort of improve what happens this fall.
Talking to John Diamond with UW-Madison. He's an education professor there, talking about what needs to happen to reopen schools. And if schools do go virtual, how to make the best of it. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you want your school to reopen in person? Your school as a teacher, a staffer, a parent, a kid. If virtual is what's happening, how do you think it can work best? Call 800-642-1234. John, Wisconsin's known, unfortunately, for a big outcome disparity among students by race. What are your thoughts on making sure that this situation doesn't take that and make it even worse?
I mean, I think one of the big challenges that we face right now is that, again, as I was saying, the resources are unequally distributed. So districts and schools have to make sure that they're not exacerbating the problem by not providing the resources necessary. I think one of the challenges of virtual learning is not everybody has equal connectivity, right? And so if you think about across urban, suburban, and rural contexts, for example, we have very disparate sort of resources. So I think it's very important to make sure that those resources become more equally distributed. And that means paying attention to both where resources are not as abundant, and also paying attention to people who may take advantage of their position to hoard educational opportunity. I know there's been some discussion, for example, about educational pods where parents are trying to hire individual teachers to work with them and their own kids in their own home, paying exorbitant amounts of money and thinking about pooling those resources to make that happen. I think it's really important for us to watch out for those kind of things happening. The other thing I think about with regard to resources and communities is thinking that all communities have assets. There's work by people like Terrence Green that look at community-based equity audits to see where the resources are in a community, see where they're inequitably distributed, and try to sort of mitigate those kinds of challenges.
On a raw resource level, schools are trying to get ready for in-person at some point, which, you know, involves maybe equipment, spacing out classrooms, stuff that takes money. They're also trying to be prepared for a quality virtual education, which in terms of technology costs money. Is the money there from the federal government, the state government, whatever, to do either of those things, much less prepare for both?
I mean, one of the challenges that we have right now is the money really isn't there, right? Because one of our, you know, because we've not necessarily done the best job of managing COVID, we have some economic challenges. There are not necessarily more resources being distributed. And the extent to which we've gotten really good guidance, as well as resources and leadership from the federal and state level, has not always been the best. So I think we're really challenged by a number of different factors at the moment that I think require, you know, sort of rapid changes and adaptation without a lot of resources. So I think that's one of our core challenges at the moment, to try to figure out how to to address those challenges and how to be thinking strategically about where the resources are needed and trying to get the resources to the folks who need to get access to them.
Now, looking at the health side of things, every state is dealing with this. I want to give a listen to one state, a Missouri Governor Mike Parson, talking about how COVID-19 impacts kids. Here's a listen.
These kids have got to get back to school. They're at the lowest risk possible. And if they do get COVID-19, which they will, and they will when they go to school, they're not going to the hospitals. They're not going to have to sit in doctor's office for days. They're going to go home, and they're going to get over it. And most of it all proves out to be that way, that if you look at the science of it.
That's Missouri Governor Mike Parson talking on a local radio program there. Do you worry about the health impacts? I know your focus is education policy, but do you worry about the health impacts, again, maybe toward communities we've seen more vulnerable to COVID-19?
Indigenous communities, Black communities, Latinx communities are disproportionately impacted. But we also know that, you know, the white community has the most cases, right? And so one of the things that I think we really have to avoid is forgetting about the health consequences. Even if a child comes home and doesn't become deathly ill, they still can pass it on to family members. They still can pass it on to other people. And you have to remember that schools are filled with children, but they're also filled with adults, right? And those people are also vulnerable. So we really have to make sure that we keep first and foremost in the forefront of our minds the health of our people in our schools, in our communities. And the faster we get the disease under control, the faster we get the pandemic under control, then the other problems start to fall by the wayside, right? Then schools can reopen. Then businesses can reopen. Then people who are, you know, sort of really trying to avoid wearing masks don't have to wear masks, right? So you sort of get the problems out of the way. But the first step is to worry about the health and getting the pandemic under control, and then you move forward. And I also feel like that statement was a bit dishonest. I think it really, it's either short-sighted or dishonest. I think we have to deal with the reality and the science as opposed to the politics.
We're talking to John Diamond, professor of education at UW-Madison. We are talking about the challenges facing schools this fall. Do they reopen with in-person classes? Do they have virtual classes, some mix of the two? Different states, different districts, taking different approaches to this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see happen in your school? If you're going to school yourself, if you're a parent, if you're a teacher, a staff member, what do you want to see happen? What is happening in your district? If you have experience now, unexpected experience, maybe dealing with virtual education, how has it worked for you? How has it worked for your school? What could make it better if it has to happen again this year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how schools across the state and country are deciding whether to reopen for the fall for in-person instruction. If they're going to go virtual, online, some combination of the two. Our guest is John Diamond, education professor at UW-Madison, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're involved in schools as a student, teacher, parent, you name it, or concerned community member, what do you want to see happen? What factors should districts consider when they think about reopening? What precautions should be taken for in-person education? What could improve online education in a pinch? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Jamie is with us in Mount Horeb. Jamie, hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to bring up, Jamie?
Yeah, hi. I had a question for the speaker. Thank you for his participation. My question is I'm wondering if he feels as though there should be different approaches based upon our children's ages. So, for example, our youngest students, kindergarten through third grade, that cannot be left at home alone during the day and have two working parents. I'm really struggling with this decision. The alternatives are I send my children to a child care center, and I'm having a hard time understanding why that's any different than necessarily a school, and why putting a child care center teacher with a group of students is more risky or less risky, or, you know, the risks, the pros and cons of that. And childcare centers have been open throughout this pandemic. And then in addition to that, if we don't send them to childcare centers, trying to find that alternative childcare solution. You know, I know we have a summer nanny who is a teacher. Obviously, our teachers are going to be back in the classrooms, albeit virtually. But many of us use college students or high school students for nannies, none of which will be available. So for working parents, it's really that struggle of, for, you know, myself having a kindergarten, second grade, and fourth grader who cannot be left at home alone, what are the options for me?
Jamie, thank you so much for that call. And Jamie's not alone, certainly, John. That factor of, you know, parents can't necessarily stay at home with their kids if they got to work.
Right. And I think it does matter what level the young people are. I have a high school son who, you know, he can be here and he can learn a lot of what he would have learned in the regular classroom. But I think she raises a really good point about the fact that some community centers have been open. There are opportunities to sort of think more broadly about where educational spaces might be. My colleague Bianca Baldrige has done a lot of work around community-based education spaces. And over the summer, I know in Madison, Lucia Community Center and other centers have been open, and they do sometimes provide additional spaces that can be utilized. So I think we need to be thinking holistically about what are the library spaces, church spaces, synagogues, other spaces in the community that might serve part of this purpose, and to what extent, if schools are not open, might we take advantage of what community resources and assets do exist? But I do think there are tough decisions to be made all around.
Jamie, thanks for calling. Good luck to you and everybody else in that situation. We'll go to John with us now in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, I was wondering, in an ideal world, what should be the federal and state government's responsibilities in this? I know that the narrative often pits teachers against parents in the responsibility of taking care of the kids. But, I mean, could the government simply offer better pandemic assistance so that parents don't have to make difficult choices like sending kids to school or being able to work?
John, thanks for the call. John Diamond, what do you think?
I mean, I think one of the ways that we can think about this is to look internationally at how other countries have handled the pandemic and think about what have been the implications in those spaces. What has worked well? What hasn't worked well? What are our scientists telling us? What are our medical experts telling us about what will work? And again, getting things under control is really important. The other challenge is we've asked state governments, for example, to come up with guidelines, but they've had to move really quickly as well. And so one of, you know, the challenges for them is that they're not used to moving that quickly. So I think the guidelines and the supports have not necessarily been as rapid as we would have liked, but I think there's still time for states to listen to what's happening in local contexts, listen to parents, listen to teachers, listen to administrators, and try to make to provide as much support as they possibly can. But again, I think a big part of our challenge is trying to get things under control so that we can move forward in the safest possible way.
Thanks a lot for that call. John, in our last couple of minutes, I think a lot of people have a feeling, last minute or so, I should say, a feeling of fear that our kids are going to lose a year of education. They're going to fall behind. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think the consequences of making the wrong decisions from a health standpoint are, I think, much more important than necessarily some loss in learning. I think we have to realize that as much as possible, we need to be providing the social emotional support that young people need to get through this period. We need to be providing it with as much education as possible. And I think our educators, who are sort of on the front lines of this, have been doing a great job of trying to create as much learning as possible. And in some ways have created new and innovative ways to try to teach, pairing back instruction to focusing on the core of what really needs to be learned, thinking about learning as opposed to grades, thinking about new ways to build relationship. So I think we can have some solace in the fact that young people are resilient. And as long as we keep them healthy, they still can have very bright futures, even if they lose out on some learning.
John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to John B. Diamond, the Kellner Family Distinguished Chair in Urban Education and Professor of Education in Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis and Faculty Affiliated African American Studies and Educational Policy Studies at UW-Madison. He joins us today to talk about how schools across the state are determining whether to reopen for in-person teaching in the fall amid the COVID-19 pandemic. You can still share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. By the way, Thursday at this time, we'll talk to an education reporter about what schools outside of Wisconsin are doing to try to get ready for the school year and how school districts can improve their virtual learning. Wisconsin Public and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with an ongoing series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. As the coronavirus pandemic enters its fifth month, the virus has claimed more than 138,000 lives in the U.S., including over 800 here in the state. Maria Clark deals with the coronavirus frequently at work as an emergency department nurse in Madison, but the virus also recently touched her personal life. She reflected late one night sitting on her porch in the summer rain.
It's 3:45 on Monday, June 22nd. It's a little odd right now. I'd just gotten done with doing a really nice Father's Day gathering with my immediate family, which is my quarantine bubble. And my sweetheart and I had come home and we were heading to bed. And as I'm brushing my teeth, he gets a message that one of his friends had just died of COVID that day. He was sad. He was more than sad. He hadn't even realized his friend was sick. And he was a sailor, like both my sweetheart and I are. And so we went out on the porch and listened to this beautiful, heavy, soaking rain that's falling. And drank little tots of dark black rum with squeezes of lime. And told stories, as sailors are prone to do. Back in early May, his friend had very just happily called him out of the blue, was checking on how he was doing with his music, how I was doing with nursing, and had decided that he was going to send us a pizza, just to be nice. He was going to buy us dinner that night. He asked what our favorite pizza place in Madison was, and we told him, and he called, and I picked it up on my way home, and we sent him a photograph of us eating it and promised we'd meet for drinks sometimes, even if it was just online. And we never did. And then tonight we get the text that he's dead. There were lots of good stories. But as the conversation meandered, you know, we got to all of the things that are happening. You know, people are still getting married, having kids, getting divorced, dying. You know, some people are doing Zoom baby showers, like another shipmate of ours and fellow musician of my sweetheart's. Some are doing scheduled visitations so people can walk by and pay their respects while not having too many people in the room at once. But so many of these individual and collective rites of passage and transition are going unmarked. And then, of course, there's the protests. I think that that's been one of the hallmarks of the pandemic. Sometimes, when you're not just in that blank limbo of routine, it's this conflict of emotions of all of these very important things happening and all of these very important other things going under the radar.
This story is part of Outbreak Wisconsin, a new series from WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the latest news in national politics, including the latest efforts in Congress and the White House to deal with the ongoing COVID-19 threat and the economic damage it's caused. We'll look at negotiations in Congress over a new possible relief package and today's press conference from the president. President Trump is sending federal law enforcement officials to states and cities saying they're needed to stop protests and prevent crime. A law professor joins us for a look at the decision, its legality, and some of the precedent it could set. And movie and TV productions were put on hold in many cases by the coronavirus. So is there any entertainment coming down the pipeline? We'll take a look at the future of the big and small screens. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, State DNR Secretary Preston Cole joins the show for a look at state parks and COVID-19 precautions, along with high-capacity wells, PFAS pollutants, and other natural resource concerns around the state. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the United States is seeing a nationwide protest movement in the midst of a major health crisis. It's not the first time this kind of dueling crisis situation has happened. Our guests are historians. They'll share some lessons from the past for today's historic moment. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.